Hi, I'm Josh, and welcome to the Wild Nature Photography Podcast, the podcast that talks the art and craft, and today my thoughts on drones of nature photography. It is the 11th of July, 2023, and this is podcast number 78. And boy, I've got a few things I want to get through today, so I think we'll just get into it. The first thing I wanted to say is I got a really cool email the other day to say that I had three photographs that I had submitted into the 2023 Bird Photographer of the Year competition have actually been selected to be included in the BPOTY annual book. And I'm pretty stoked about that because they have thousands and thousands and thousands of entries every year for this. And this is the first time I've actually ever entered this competition. And I received an email maybe 6 months ago now saying a few of my photographs had made the finals. And that was pretty cool. I was pretty happy about that. And, you know, to be honest, I get those kind of emails quite a bit where I say I've made the finals and then sometimes they just don't go anywhere else. That's just how it goes sometimes. But this time, three of them have actually been included in the book and will be in the new book. So I'm pretty happy about that. I mean, I made a post about it on my written blog, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes, including to Bird Photographer of the Year. You can pre-order their book at the moment. I did a review on these Bird Photographer of the Year books maybe 10 podcasts ago. I might try and put a link to that in the show notes as well, if I remember. And I really like them. I think they're really, really well-done books. They're a hardcover, large-format, coffee-table-style book. And they're full of beautiful images. If you have even a passing interest in bird photography, I would really encourage you to check these out. Not just because I'm going to be in the new one, but because they are a fantastic reference on how to photograph birds and the things that you should be trying to do when you are out photographing birds. And believe it or not, birds are actually one of the things that I am asked about the most when I'm out photographing. People say to me, how do I get good birds in flight shots? Well, my answer to that is get the Bird Photographer of the Year books and have a look how other people have done it, because there are fantastic examples in there along with all the metadata information so you can see what lens it was shot with, what f-stop, what shutter speed, where it was photographed, the conditions that it was photographed in, and you can learn an awful lot. And that's how I learned a lot about how to photograph birds, through books like this. And of course, field practice as well goes a long way towards this, especially with birds in flight. But with the new mirrorless cameras, particularly with eye tracking, it's never been easier than it is now to photograph birds in flight and to be able to get sharp photographs. So anyway, I'm pretty chuffed about that. I'm looking forward to seeing that book when it's released. I think it's going to be towards the end of this year. They still have to announce the actual competition winners, and I believe that's in late September. So, yeah, I'll be looking for that, and I'll have more to say about that, obviously, if my images go any further. But certainly having them in the finals and having them included in the book is fantastic. The next thing I wanted to come to was I had some fantastic feedback on the last podcast where I did a comparison between Lenscote and Elfegard. So thank you to those who took the time to write to me about that. It was an interesting comparison, not an inexpensive one, because notwithstanding the fact that I threw all the Elfegard in the bin at the end. Now, what I didn't actually say in that review and what I forgot to include is that as I was pulling the Elfegard off the Canon lens shade, that's the lens shade for the 600mm, it actually took quite a bit of paint off the lens shade as well. So I'm not too happy about that. And that really marks the product down in my book. So, just be aware of that. If you are fitting Elfegard to a lens, it took the paint off my 600mm lens shade. Only in one spot, only on the rim, the backside rim, but nevertheless, not too happy about that. If you are going to remove Elfegard from a lens, I would encourage you to use a hairdryer just to heat it up a little bit and make it a little bit softer and easy to pull off, because I did struggle with getting it off a little bit, particularly around the lens hood, and as a result, I lost some paint. Not that I'm too concerned about that. I certainly won't be replacing the lens shade just because it's got a little bit of lost paint. They're around about the $600 mark to replace, but I would have preferred that didn't happen. I guess that just finishes off on the Lenscote Elfegard argument. My thoughts were pretty well summed up in that review, but thank you to those of you who took the time to give me feedback on that podcast. It was very much appreciated, and it's good to know that you want more of that sort of topic, where I'm talking about, you know, different competing products that we may or may not be using and which one is better and which one I find more useful and more cost effective, etc. Okay, a couple of other housekeeping items. Before we get to the topic of the day, I have just put up a new expedition for 2025 called Ultimate Polar Bears of the High Arctic. This is an all-new expedition that has come about as a result of a number of factors. The first of which is that there are all new regulations coming into effect in Svalbard. No one knows exactly when some of these regulations are coming into effect, and some of them are already in effect. But in short, what it's going to mean is that the number of landing sites in Svalbard is going to be highly restricted. But on top of that, if the polar bear restrictions come into place, it's going to mean that you can't approach a polar bear within 500 meters. And that's just going to be the death of polar bear photography in Svalbard. So I decided to put together a new expedition that was going to focus entirely on polar bears in the high Arctic, and that I was going to do it north of the archipelago of Svalbard, where these rules and regulations don't apply. So this will be a 19-day expedition. Now that's nearly twice as long, what is twice as long, I should say, as most typical expeditions for polar bears to Svalbard. And the reason I did that is I wanted to have a very good or extensive amount of time to be able to go well north, east and west of Svalbard in search of polar bears, and to be able to spend a lot of time in the pack ice, because that's the best place to find and photograph polar bears when they're in their natural environment and they're on the ice hunting. Polar bears are always great to see, even if they are seen on land, but it's just not such a great photographic opportunity if you see a polar bear walking on clean rocks or dirt-covered rocks or a sandy beach. It's always nicer to see them on snow and ice. So this trip will be in the middle of the year in 2025. I have literally just opened it for bookings. All the places are sold out. I've got one place remaining only before this trip's going to be completely full. So if you're keen on that and you want to know more, just email me and I will send you some more information, including a detailed PDF that has the itinerary, the details, the costs, etc. So I'm pretty excited about that. The other trip I've just put up for 2025 is to Zululand in South Africa. This is for the Ground Level Wildlife Masterclass. It's going to be a repeat of the trip that I did this year. I am also running it next year. Next year was actually already sold out, but I just had two places become available on next year's trip. A couple have to move to the 2025 trip. So anyway, there's an option now at the moment for either 2024 to grab the last couple of places on that trip or to come with me in 2025. And this particular location in Zululand, South Africa that we are going to is, I believe, the best place in Africa for ground level photography. We get out of the vehicles, we walk with the cheetahs, we photograph them at eye level from the ground. You can see examples of this photography on my website. We have a number of overnight hides that we can photograph from that give you incredible opportunities to photograph elephants, giraffes, zebras, lions, whatever might come to the drinking hole at night, and really provide very unique photographs that have not been previously seen and are very, very different to what you might see from a traditional safari vehicle. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in that, even if you've been to Africa many, many times, I promise you, you will have not had this experience before. There is nothing like lying on the ground with wild cheetahs and having them come towards you and be able to photograph them at eye level. It just makes all the difference in the world to the power, to the emotion, and how evocative the final photograph really is. When you're trying to create wildlife images, those are key things. You really need to get that animal at eye level, and that just can't be done from a traditional safari vehicle. We'll also have access to a new vehicle. We tested it this year, which has been highly modified to allow for low-level photography, and that's also going to be available to us both next year and 2025. So dates for both of these are up on my website as well. You can check those out if you're interested. And the last bit of workshop news is I'm also putting on a trip in 2025 for the White Horses of Camargue in France. It's in southern France. This is an opportunity to really hone your wildlife skills. It's wildlife in a controlled environment. The horses are not fully wild. They are wrangled by skilled handlers. And we will have an opportunity to photograph them twice a day, both in the morning and in the evening in good light, as they run towards us through either marsh or ocean water or on a beach. And it's just going to be a great opportunity to perfect your wildlife, to practice slow shutter speed in the field when you've got an opportunity to do repeats, to do the same thing again and again. And this is something I think all of us can benefit from, even myself as a full-time wildlife nature photographer. I can benefit from spending some time perfecting and honing my skills. So this is going to be a very comfortable workshop. We'll be staying in a very, very nice five-star hotel in southern France. The details for this I've just put up on my website, so you can check that out. We're going to have a total of 8 sessions with the horses, so that will be 2 sessions per day, 1 in the morning and 1 in the evening. And that's going to give us a pretty incredible opportunity to create a very strong portfolio of work of the white horses, but do it in a controlled environment and in such a way where we can really perfect our techniques. And then you can take those techniques and apply them on your next trip where you're actually dealing with real wildlife. It's not going to be a zoo situation in France. We are going to be working, you know, out in the open, in nature, as it were. It's just that the horses are controlled by skilled wranglers. So we have a great opportunity there to create pretty diverse portfolio of images of the horses. I am looking forward to this very much. It should be a fantastic chance to not only do the shooting, but also we're going to have time during the day to review what we've shot, discuss the images, and see where we went wrong and see where we went right. So I want to do a lot of extensive feedback during this workshop and really pass on my thoughts on why particular images work, some particular images work and are more strong than others that perhaps don't work quite so well. So we're going to have a lot of slideshows. There'll be a lot of chit-chat. We'll cover post-production as well as looking at raw files. I think it's important to be looking at the raw files too, and then how best to optimize those raw files as well. So that's also coming up in 2025. It'll be later in 2025. And again, the details are up on my website, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well for those of you who are interested. Whew, one last news item. I have just finished unboxing, testing and reviewing BenQ's brand new SW272U photographic monitor. Now, this is a new 4K Adobe RGB monitor. It's the evolution of the SW271C, I think it was. Fantastic display. I'll be releasing a video on this in the next few days, I hope. So just keep an eye on my written blog for that. My thanks to Tony Knight at This Is My Life for helping me film it and giving up his morning to help me prepare the video, because there was a lot for us to go through, not just the unboxing and the installation, but I wanted to do a full run through on BenQ's new PMU software, or Palette Master Ultimate software, because this new software is, I believe, in my experience anyway, the easiest to use software I've yet come across for calibration of photographic displays. It's very, very easy to do. It's very, very easy to follow. And it gives you some fantastic feedback as well on how a display performed at the end of the process. So that will be included in the video. It will be the full walkthrough on Palette Master Ultimate software. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the Hot Puck. You'll see what that is in the video as well. It's now gone wireless, which is really incredible. I love that. It's a fantastic tool now that it's gone wireless and now that you can also access the full BenQ menu structure from the Hot Puck without having to fiddle around behind the display or underneath the display to access buttons. So I think that's really, really cool. And the ability to charge a laptop via USB-C off the monitor through the video connection is also a fantastic feature. So overall, I'm really, really pleased with this new monitor. I think bang for buck. As I've said before, I don't think this can be beaten for the money. You can spend a lot more than this on a photographic monitor from a company such as Azo, for example. And really, you're not buying anything in performance that the BenQ doesn't deliver. It's just going to be incredible performance for the money. So I think that about sums up my review of the SW272U. Just a phenomenal display. Okay, so let's come to the topic of the day, which is going to be drones. So, and drones in wildlife photography particularly. Now, my thanks to Anil for this subject suggestion via his email. This has been something I wanted to talk about for quite some time. It's been on my list. I just haven't got around to it. It's topical for me because I have been contemplating and toying with buying a drone for a long, long time now. Not for wildlife photography, though, as I think I said in a previous podcast, but specifically for spotting wildlife. Because there are times when I've been up in the Arctic on ships or on snowmobile, and I've thought to myself, boy, it would be really great to have a drone right now and be able to fly it up and over the mountains to look for polar bears or other wildlife. So I am going to buy a drone this year. It will be within the next month. It's going to probably be almost certainly the new small DJI. I think it's the Mavic 3 Mini now. I might be wrong on that. on that model number, I'm just not completely up to date. I don't follow the website that closely for the different models, and they change frequently. But whatever the smallest drone is, that's the one I intend to buy. And as I said, I intend to buy it primarily for spotting wildlife, not for actually shooting images. But I want to talk about the use of drones in general, not just from a wildlife perspective, but primarily wildlife. I guess the first thing to say is drones do provide a very unique perspective that's not available from traditional photography, both in terms of elevation and proximity and angle to animals or wildlife. And that can be really, really interesting. Obviously, there's an ethical argument with the use of drones around wildlife. I have seen footage of polar bears being chased by drones. That's something that I believe is very, very inappropriate. Thankfully now, photographers seem to have more or less settled down with their ethics and ethos in relation to the use of drones around wildlife. Most people are very, very careful. And drones have also become a lot more quiet and a lot less obtrusive than they used to be. So I think, you know, as long as you are using a drone respectfully around wildlife, from a high up altitude where it's not bothering or disturbing the wildlife in any sort of way, shape or form, I don't really have a problem with it, because there are opportunities to create photographs. A polar bear is a great example. If you've got a polar bear walking through a very large open area of deep snow, it's going to leave a fantastic track behind it. And that track might be something that you can use as a leading line in a drone photograph from a perspective you certainly couldn't get any other way. So I do believe there's a time and a place for the use of drones with wildlife photography, provided that the use is respectful amongst to the wildlife first and foremost. I think that's the key to this, is as long as the use of the drone is being respectful of the wildlife, not disturbing the wildlife, not chasing the wildlife or interfering it with it in any way, I don't have an issue with it. And I think now with the modern drones being the way they are, it's quite okay to use drones around wildlife in that fashion. Of course, it's getting harder and harder to use drones in various locations around the world because they're simply banned. This is the case down in Antarctica, where you cannot use drones at all unless you apply to IATA, which is the governing body for tourism in Antarctica. And if you have the required, I think you actually might even need a commercial pilot's license. I'm not 100% on that to say for sure if that's the case, but I'm pretty sure it is. I know up in Iceland, there are many places that drones are no longer allowed to be used. And I believe Svalbard has also been talking about banning the use of drones. Here in Australia, drones are banned in almost all the national parks. So their use has been heavily curtailed. To be honest with you, I find a lot of the drone photographs that I'm seeing quite banal, quite ordinary. It was a new perspective when we first all saw it several years ago, but now it's a perspective that has been done more or less to death over the glacial rivers in Iceland, over the glacial rivers in New Zealand, over the glaciers in New Zealand, in many places around the world. So I feel that their use now is best served is part of an overall video where someone's making a video, let's say, about photography in the African desert, and they have some drone shots inside that video. I think that's the best use of drones these days from a video perspective anyway, when they're incorporated into a documentary of some sort, to give that different perspective, that larger aerial perspective, an epic feeling that you perhaps can't get any other way. That's a very, very good use of drones. Drone still imagery of landscapes, I feel it's very hard to do something unique now because so much has been done with drones as they've become so accessible over the last number of years. I think that's going to continue to be the case. Of course, we're going to see some incredible drone images and competitions and on social media and things like that. But most of them are pretty ordinary in my experience. There really isn't that much to set them apart from the plethora of other drone images that are out there in the field these days. When it comes to the use of drones around our favorite feathered friends, so birds, I think we need to be especially careful, because I have seen drones flying around glaciers in Svalbard where the birds, particularly skuas, polar skuas, have started to attack the drone. I've seen instances in Iceland where a drone has been flown up near a waterfall and a gyrfalcon has gone on to attack the drone. Flying drones around nesting birds is obviously a no-no. Flying drones to access areas that are meant to be off-limits, areas such as Salisbury Plain in South Georgia, for example, has areas that are off limits. And flying a drone over those areas that are off limits, I think, is a little bit pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable with a drone. Obviously, a lot depends on altitude. A lot depends on the potential for scaring the wildlife that's there. All of these things, I think, really need to be taken into consideration. But I think extra care needs to be taken with birds because particularly raptors, buzzards, things like that, will typically view drones as a threat and may attack the drone, could get injured attacking the drone. They could end up wrecking the drone as well. That's obviously a secondary concern to looking after the wildlife. But I think you just need to be extremely careful in those sort of situations that we're not only not disturbing the birds, not flying it around nesting areas or pushing birds off nests, but being respectful of their airspace. Many birds are territorial. Falcons are no exception. And we need to make sure that we're conscious of that and we don't fly our drones into those areas. I don't want to sound like I'm preaching on this. I just think it's important to be aware of this before you lift a drone in an area where there might be birds. I have seen gulls attack birds as well up in the Arctic, glaucus gulls particularly. And I have seen many birds also scared off by the use of drones. So it's just something to be aware of. I think you need to take even more caution and more care around our avian feathered friends than you do perhaps with mammals, just because we're sharing airspace. Now, something else that's worth covering over here is there is a competitive advantage to using drones in certain situations against photographers who are not using drones. So by way of that, what I'm getting at in this statement is if you're out on an expedition and you're photographing on a ship with a group of people and one of those people happens to have a drone and they lift that drone up, obviously that gives them an edge to get perspectives and things like that that other photographers can't get. Now, personally, I don't have too much of an issue with that as long as I guess that drone and the drone operator are not interfering with any of the other photographers' work. I think flying a drone from a ship into low around an iceberg where other photographers are photographing is a no-no. I think that's just going to end up in a lot of upset photographers who don't want to have to clone a drone out of their work. And that's fair enough too, because, you know, if you're photographing nature, as I often am, particularly icebergs from ships, or wildlife from ships, I don't want to have to clone a drone out of the image. And if I was going to go and use that image in a competition, many of which don't allow you to clone items out, I then can't use that image. So, nor do I want to have to clone it out anyway. I want my image to be a capture of nature. So as operators, drone operators, I do think it's incumbent on us to be extremely respectful of other photographers around us. You know, perhaps walk, if you're going to fly a drone, and you can walk away to a different area away from the photographers. Be on your own. When I've had a photographer come down to Antarctica with a drone who did have a commercial pilot's license and had all the permits, what we did was we actually arranged to drop him in a different location on land, well away from everywhere else, where he could then fly his drone and get the images that he wanted. This way, he's not interfering with any of the other photographers. He's not in the way. I think that's also very, very important. Now, I want to come to the topic of drones as pollution, because I hate to think how many drones there are out there that are lying at the bottom of the ocean and rivers nowadays. It's many, many tens of thousands. Personally, I have probably seen in excess of 100 drones crashed in my time over the last 10 years leading and guiding expeditions and workshops in the polar regions of the world. They often get lost when we're on ships. They get confused by the ship's radar. Or they get crashed into an iceberg, or they get lost in fog, or their battery goes flat. They refuse to return home when you hit the home button, or they return home and the ship's moved on. They crash into the wall of a waterfall. There are any number of reasons why a drone might be lost. And the problem with them is that they're made of plastic and that they're going to sit at the bottom of the ocean or at the bottom of that river for many, many, many years before they break down, probably hundreds of years. So that's a lot of pollution we're putting into the ocean, and it's or rivers, and it's unnecessary in my experience. So now the drones have gotten much better at collision avoidance in recent generations, which is a very, very good thing. So therefore, they're less likely to collide, and usually with an object. Usually when they are lost, it's almost always user error. You know, you've got someone flying it back. I had someone fly a drone back to a ship when we were out on a Svalbard trip. I think it was 2 years ago now, And as they were bringing in into land, the ship turned, the drone clipped the edge of the ship, and luckily, could have gone either way, but luckily the drone fell onto the deck of the ship rather than into the water. If it had fallen into the water, it would have been yet another lost drone to Neptune. Now, there is a funny aspect to this, of course. Many of the ships up in the Arctic keep a scoreboard of how many drones they've actually lost each year. And look, there is some humour there to be had because you can walk up on the bridge. And I know the crew love writing down that yet another drone has been lost to the ocean. But there is a sad side to this, and it's not just the cost. It's the industrial pollution of putting a drone with a lithium-ion battery into the ocean that's then lost forever to pollute the waters. So we should be aware of that. We need to be extra careful when we are using drones because we don't want them to end up as pollution in rivers and lakes and things like that and oceans, because I have no doubt there are a great many out there. I know you can purchase insurance for your drone so that if you do crash it into the ocean, they'll replace it for you. I don't think that makes it better. It just makes the financial hit a bit more acceptable, whereas it's still pollution. So that's, again, just a bit of a bugbear of mine, because I guess because I've seen so many drones crashed and it's very hard to retrieve them. Typically, you know, when a drone is crashed, it's lost in water and that's the end of the drone. Even if it is retrieved, the electronics are all dead because of the salt water that's been ingressed into the drone. So drone retrieval is actually very, very difficult most of the time. It might be crashed very high up on a steep mountainside and in a place that's impossible to get to, or, as I said, crashed in a river, a lake, the ocean, and just impossible to retrieve. So these are things to be aware of. Changing gears slightly on drones, most competitions these days have a drone category. So when drones were first coming on the market, we started to see drone images in the landscape category most commonly. And many of those images did very, very well. And some of them even won the category because it was a very new, very unique perspective. Nowadays, that's no longer the case. All the judges have seen this perspective, but they've seen it done before, whether it was actually done from a helicopter or a drone. But nowadays, most competitions have a drone category or an aerial category, and that's the place for those sort of images. I think that's a fantastic thing. It's good that those who want to use drones for photography, stills or video, have a place where they can enter those photographs, because the angle of view, the perspective is unique. It is different to what we can get as a terrestrial photographer, so it's good that there's a place for this. I have no issues with that. I'm actually very pleased that we have that. Almost all the competitions have adopted it, which I think is a very good thing as well. In fact, just on that, I think it would actually be very good if some of the competitions that have adopted aerials as a separate category actually also adopted camera traps as a separate category. Camera trap images have been on the rise a lot, and I don't want to get sort of segue onto camera traps too much, but we've seen a lot of camera trap images win competitions over the last years, including some very big competitions like BBC Wildlife Photographer of the Year. Now, the images have been great. I've got no problem with that. But what I do believe is that it's not the same as the photographer pressing the button or the photographer sitting out there in the field in the hide for days at a time to capture the photograph. It's different. You know, I have a friend of mine who does a lot of camera trap photography in parts of Russia with very, very rare Amur leopards and Siberian tigers. And he has managed to create, it's a great setup he's got. He's now got cameras out in the field for up to 6 months running off very large car batteries in order to capture the images that he's getting. Now, they're great images, don't get me wrong, and they're well and truly award-winning images, but he wasn't there to press the shutter. And it's an important distinction, I think. So I would personally like to see a separate category for camera trap images as well in most of these competitions. We'll see whether we get it or not. I don't know. But the fact that we started to get it for aerial work and for drone images, I think is a very good thing. Drone images, just back on drones, have very much been on the rise. And there's a large number of reasons for that. The first of which, of course, is that drones are just much more accessible than they've ever been before. They're cheaper than they've ever been before. There are a number of different options on the market. They're smaller. They're easier to travel with than they used to be. And they fold down into a much smaller space and they're lighter. So there are lots of reasons why it's beneficial to use a drone these days and to carry a drone. Sometimes on expeditions that I have done, one of my guides who helps me has had a drone with him, and we put it up and we get shots of the boat going through the pack ice and very unique perspectives that we then share with the group. of photographers on the trip, because it's a great memento as well to go home with a little bit of footage of the ship you were on plowing through the pack ice in beautiful light. I think it's a nice thing to have, to be able to show the family when you get home, show friends, hey, this is what it was like out on this expedition. One of the guides had a drone and let me have this footage. I think there's a strong argument for that sort of use and that sort of sharing. So I'm not by any means anti-drone. I think the use of drones just needs to be well controlled, especially around wildlife. Landscape, less so, as long as we're not losing the drone, crashing it or making it into pollution. But certainly around wildlife, we have to be very, very careful not to disturb the wildlife, particularly around birds, especially birds, because we're sharing airspace with them as well. So, but I do think there is a strong use for drones. And as I said, I plan to purchase one myself very shortly. I'm going to take it with me when I leave Australia in August for... I'll be in Sweden to start with, but then I'll be up in Finland and also Greenland and Iceland before returning to Australia. So I've got three dedicated trips. Now, the first one of those trips for wolves, primarily for wolves, but also for brown bears and wolverine, we will take the drone, or I should say I will take the drone, and I'm going to put it up in the air, but I'm going to put it up extremely high and use it just to scout for the wolves. Because we're sitting in hides, I'm just going to use it as a bit of a test to see how effective it is in letting me know where the wildlife is and when the wildlife is approaching. So I'm going to do a bit of a test with that drone. And the second opportunity will be up in Greenland, where again, I hope to get some shots of the ship going through the ice just to share with the group on the trip, but also to help spot for polar bears from the air, because that aerial perspective just gives you the edge when you're looking for wildlife. So I think it'll be useful for that. That's the primary reason I want it. I don't really want it to make aerial photographs. It's not something I'm that interested in doing. It's more about spotting wildlife. And of course, I'll take my binoculars for spotting from the ground or the ship, but the drone just gives me a different perspective for spotting wildlife. So I think that's what I wanted to cover on drones, really. As I said, I'm going to look at buying the small Mavic Mini, which I think is the smallest of the drones, or one of the smaller drones anyway, certainly very easy to travel with. I'm just looking at a very, very basic kit. If I was doing a lot of video work, which I have toyed with, but I really isn't for me, I might look at one of the drones that had a higher resolution camera for better quality to incorporate those drone shots into the film or the documentary that I was making. There is definitely a place for that. And it just, there is no other way to get sort of a scale sometimes than there is with the drone shots. So I believe they have a place. And it's taken drones a long time to find their place as well, which they seem to have now settled into a nice niche as well. So I think that's a very good thing as well. So I think we'll wrap it up on drones there for now. If you want to share your thoughts with me on drones, let me know. If you've got a different viewpoint to me, or you've got a counterpoint, or you feel like I missed something out on drones, just let me know, and I can always add to it in my next podcast. I'm always up for a good debate on things like drones. So I think that's about it for today. It is, what did I say it was today? It's the 11th, I think, today. Yeah, the 11th of July. So I have about a month and 10 days here now in Australia before I'm going to be flying out for Northern Europe, which is nice to have a bit of time on my hands. I have been very, very busy though. I have been drafting articles for magazines, preparing images for magazines, working on PDFs for upcoming trips, things like the ultimate polar bear trip I was talking about, the White Horses of Camagüey in France, and more as well. So 2025 is getting close to being fully planned out now. There's a couple of other things I'm still working on. I'll have more to say about those soon. Other than that, the rest of this year, after I finish this next trip, is going to be all about Antarctica. I'll have more to say about that in future podcasts as well. This has been a trip that's been in the planning for more than a couple of years now, so pretty excited about going back down to Antarctica on Polar Pioneer since it's been refitted. That should be fantastic as well. So there is a lot going on. I've talked about the BenQ monitor review. As I said, I'll have that, I hope, up on my website in the next couple of days. Videos filming is finished. Editing is finished. I've got the video here. I'm just waiting on the final okay from BenQ to release it. And because the monitor is still actually not available to purchase, you can still only pre-order at the moment. Although I have one sitting here on my desk one of the benefits, I guess, of being a BenQ ambassador. But very nice to have this new monitor. Incredible display. And as I said, thoroughly recommended. Just bang for buck. It just can't be beat. So I think that's about it for now. There's been some interesting talk about various things from Canon. We won't go into much more of that today. I think most of it's just rumor mongering. I think the new lenses that are going to be of most interest to me coming later this year is going to be the 200 to 500. When that comes, I'll get hold of my hands on that for testing. And no doubt I'll do a podcast about that as well. So that's it for today. I'm Josh. It has been the 11th of July, 2023, podcast number 78, did I say? I think it's 78. I have such a bad memory. Yes, it is. 78. Look forward to seeing you out in the field. Take care.